many people are here for the first time at Brooklyn Zen Center or Love Circle Sangha? Okay, great. Yeah, so the Brooklyn Zen Center hosts Love Circle Sangha, and there are many people who are contacting me that thought they were coming to a Brooklyn Zen Center event. And so this is not a Brooklyn Zen Center event, although they are in a Zen tradition. It's a different tradition, and this may already be throwing people who are coming from outside Buddhism, what we're referring to as the Dharma, which is just a word we use. Literal meaning is the truth or law, which is how we refer to the teachings. I'll be using that word a lot too, so the Dharma. So there are many expressions of the Dharma, and Love Circle Sangha is a very, very beautiful expression of it. So if you are interested in what's happening here today and want to learn more, please talk to Danielle and Beatrice. They're really lovely people. So in kind of harmony with that introduction to the Dharma, we've passed out these little sheets of paper. Danielle and Bia asked me if there was anything that I wanted to have for this event. And although, you know, many of our entryway into meditation is secular, or maybe what we'll call Dharma light, for many of us, we practice in these root traditions. And this project of the reclamation of the sacred is reclaiming the voice, and particularly chanting. The silence of Western Dharma is kind of deafening, I find. So I want to invite you into a chant. It's a Sri Lankan melody. It's the first one, I think, the Buddham, Buddham chant. And just to contextualize it, so this is a chant of the refuges. And the refuge chant is something that's chanted daily in Asia and across the world. And you know, for those of you who are new to this, just to recognize this is not a theistic practice necessarily for many of us. And if you can, you don't have to chant if you don't want to, but if you can, to tap into the energetic quality of what we're doing by giving voice to these refuges. So the chant Buddham, 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 one day is a chant of taking refuge in this quality of awakening. Buddha is what we refer to as that guy, but it means the awakened one. And so it's a quality, an innate possibility for each of us. So we're taking refuge in that possibility. Dhamma is Dharma in Pali, and it's the quality of truth and this possibility for us to really see things clearly without the veils of oppression or our own pain and suffering, to take refuge in that. And Sangha refers to the community, but it's really this quality of love and relationality. And I always like to start these meetings not in silence, which is the tendency in this culture, but in connection and conversation, because that is Sangha. And I call her the stepsister refuge because we don't pay much attention to her. So some of you know this melody, and you can join me right away, and others of you can follow along. Please forgive my singing voice. And from there, we'll be doing a meditation. How many of you have never meditated before? Oh, great. So I'll do a very sort of gentle introduction to the practice of just settling us, but really leave space for us to see what arises today.
Buddham, 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 one day. Dhamma, 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 one day. Sangham, Sangham. Buddha, one day. Buddha.
So as you settle in, perhaps feeling the resonance of the chanting and the bell, and my invitation to all of us today is to open to a sensual exploration of our practice that is rooted in the body. So connecting to the felt sense of your experience today. Settling down from the head to the seat. Can we feel our way into this practice? Can we feel our way into liberation? Not choosing or rejecting any experience. Simply allowing what's happening, being curious, being kind and compassionate. Being easeful. Can you listen deeply to your experience? Can you listen deeply to what's felt in the body? Can you open to it with kindness? What sensations are heard and felt right now? Letting thoughts be and re-relaxing into the body. In a moment, I'll ring the bell. My invitation to you is a couple of minutes of mindful movement, but to enter into that through the body. And by that I mean to not go into reflexive stretches or releases that come from the head or habit. After the bell is rung, to simply rest in listening, to knowing what's needed in the body right now. Just slowly responding to whatever's called for. So welcome again, everyone. Apparently, if you put erotic in the title of your talk, everybody comes. No. Now you know how to get everyone to your events. For some reason, I was talking to Bay about this. I thought this was 3 hours. So I envisioned it as a workshop, and I realized that it's only 2 hours. So it's going to be more of a talk, which kind of contradicts my thesis, which you'll hear about. But I'm wondering how many people have to leave exactly at 3:30? Okay. So if we run over a little bit, primarily for the discussion portion. You know, I tried to, even with a talk, I kept the meditation short and tried to leave enough room for interaction and discussion, knowing that it was going to be a big group. Just according to the RSVPs, it had to be somewhat talky because there are just so many of you. So as you know, the talk is entitled "The Erotic as Power: Exploring the Feminine in Your Spiritual Practice." And it's inspired by the essay "Uses of the Erotic as Power" by Audre Lorde. For the last couple of years, I've been a little obsessed with that essay and thinking a lot about it in relationship to the feminine, and specifically to the absence of the feminine or its diminishment in Buddhism, and in my own spiritual practice. How many of you have read that essay? Oh, great. Good. And how many of you are new to Dharma practice? Like, really don't have a lot of experience with it? Okay. And I think there was no one new to meditation, which is great. But I didn't ask after people arrived, is there anyone that's new to meditation as a whole? Okay, good. So that helps with definitions. So Audre Lorde's main message in this essay, and really in her work, is about how the political and spiritual and erotic are not separate, but they have been separated by these oppressive systems. And this essay, she talks about the liberatory nature of the erotic. And I always perk up when I hear the word liberatory or liberation. That's why I was attracted to the Dharma originally, because it talked about liberation and freedom. And I came to the Dharma and kind of my political consciousness around the same time. And so it seemed like a place where I could find a fullness in that, having grown up in a political consciousness of surrounded by that was about struggle and armed revolution and war, and recognizing the limits of that, wanting something that was fully liberatory. And what I learned is that the Dharma talks about liberation, but similar to liberation theology, which many of you might be familiar with, this movement started in Latin America that wanted to take the teachings of Christianity and Jesus' words into a political consciousness. I feel like we need a liberation Dharma. And I think that a big part of liberation Dharma is liberation biology and liberation psychology. And so using the wisdom of the Dharma, which is so profound, to start to make sense of how it works in our own lives in the real world. So when Audre Lorde in this essay talks about this connection between liberation, politics, sexuality, the erotic, and the spiritual, it really spoke to me. So when she talks about the erotic, she's not only talking about the sexual, although the erotic includes the sexual. She's talking about our deepest non-rational knowing. She calls it the power of our unexpressed or unrecognized feeling, our creative energy empowered. She connects this to what she calls the female, I'm calling the feminine, and to the body. So our time together, even if we run over, is really short. So I can't do justice to all of these things in such a short time. I want to offer up some frames and some themes. And I hope we have chances in our own lives or together to explore it in the future. But it is going to be a bit sketchy, so forgive me if I'm not speaking clearly or deeply enough about certain things. And I want to emphasize that these are my frames and perspectives, and they may not resonate for some of you. And in the discussion and conversation, I really hope that you'll share with each other and with me things that may contradict or may connect or may add to the richness. I also, I'm going to start with a lot of disclaimers. I'm going to, I do not understand this topic fully in any way whatsoever, and I'm not claiming that. It's something that continues to surprise and challenge me in my own life. And a lot of it is because of my own conditioning. And conditioning, as I'll talk about later when I reveal how much I don't know this topic, is largely unconscious. So I can't see also the ways that I'm stuck around this. And I think that any of us who have gone through at least middle school or high school, which I imagine most of us have, if not all of us, we are conditioned by the society around us to not get this in a certain way. And that's what schools do. That's what they're designed to do, is keep us from not connecting to the feminine, not connecting to the body, not connecting to our own liberation. On top of that, my last disclaimer, I swear, is I am very conditioned to being in my head because I tend to understand things conceptually. And I think like a lot of people who are attracted to Western Dharma, especially my tradition, the Theravada Insight tradition, we love our texts. So we may all have some conditioning by this culture, and we may have it to varying degrees. So where I'm saying I'm stuck may not be where you're stuck. And some of you might have examined this reclamation of the feminine much more deeply than me. So just to acknowledge that we all are in different places. And to say that, you know, rational knowledge, concepts, language, I'm going to be using a lot of words to explain what is wordless in a lot of ways. It's not a bad thing. I love it. I love language. I love metaphor. I love thinking. But again, it's about this reclamation of the feminine. And for some of us, that phrase might feel really foreign or uncomfortable, or we just don't really know what we're talking about. And that's OK, too, because this is a process for all of us. So my hope is that we leave here today with at least a little inspiration for the imagining and the practice of this reclamation in our lives. And that'll look different for each one of us. I'm not going to spend too much time defining terms because that takes a lot of time. And so we need to agree that language is complex and that things won't be able to be clearer unless we spend all our time on definitions. And it's really important to be clear about what we're talking about, but there is going to be some grayness today, especially because we're not going to stay there too long. But I will say that for this event, when I say feminine, I'm really talking about what could be labeled yin, as in yin and yang, or the sacred feminine. And that's in relationship to yang, the sacred masculine. And that these are energetic and elemental qualities. So yin is classically described as being receptive, about depth and darkness, about the material density. It's often associated with the moon. And I like to think of it as a deep listening. And yang, with the masculine, with active, with height and lightness, with energy and space, with often associated with the sun, and can be thought of as acting. And they are both all things. They're dynamic forces. They're not oppositional, and they contain each other. And it's not the same as culturally defined ideas of feminine or masculine or femininity or feminist, which are largely associated with women, and we could maybe call the social feminine. It's an energetic quality that's in everything. Everything, everyone, all of nature is both yin and yang. And there's a whole other talk about how that's related to the diminishment of the sacred feminine is related to colonialism and the decimation of indigenous cultures, the destruction of nature. I'm not going to touch on that today. There's also an inherent challenge in this that we're talking about binaries or dualism. And the sacred is not dualistic. So, but our using language and rational minds, it immediately becomes opposing, contradicting forces. And I cannot get into that today, a deconstruction of dualism. But just to say that we're using language to look at this imbalance, but it's actually not, it is still one. So I'll try to remember to say sacred feminine to try not to confuse it with our social reality. But this deepest intuitive knowing, this depth, this listening, this quality of receptivity has been devalued and destroyed throughout history. And it's played out in many ways, energetically, spiritually, but also politically and socially. And this overemphasis on the sacred masculine has been about materially and politically devaluing and oppressing women and the feminine, the social feminine. So just to flag that's a reality. Even though we're talking about elemental qualities, we're also talking about the role or lack of role of women and the feminine in Buddhism and in our spiritual lives. So Audre Lorde says, we have been taught to suspect this resource, the erotic. And I'm going to use erotic and sacred feminine interchangeably here. To suspect this resource, vilified, abused, and devalued in Western society. On the one hand, the superficially erotic has been encouraged as a sign of female inferiority. She calls that the pornographic. On the other hand, women have been made to suffer and to feel both contemptible and suspect by virtue of its existence. And what really struck me in that paragraph is the phrase, its existence. I really think it's important because the erotic and the sacred feminine didn't go anywhere. It's not lost. It's actually right here all the time. It is in everything, and we need to open to it. I think a lot of our political discourse or our past liberation attempts have been about thinking that there's a lack and that it's in opposition, but it's not. It's actually right here, and what we need to do is slow down and open to it. We're not pitting the feminine against the masculine. It's not even about lessening the masculine necessarily, because again, it's all here in balance already. It's not some cosmic scale that we're trying to rebalance. That's very arrogant of us to think that it's all about us. It's not masculine against feminine, men against women. The power problem is patriarchy, not the masculine. As bell hooks says, patriarchy has no gender. Also, patriarchy has no winners. One of patriarchy's primary tactics is to keep us all, whatever gender, from feeling the feminine, because if we feel it, like really, really feel it, we can't be good consumers, we can't be good students, we can't be good workers, we can't be good prisoners. We can't be good soldiers. So when she talks about the erotic as this deep knowing that touches into a feminine plane within us, she's talking about that suchness that's already here. It's not something that needs to be generated or created. It needs a reclamation. And she's talking about this ability to feel fully and live deeply into our lives and to our experience, not for stimulation. So when I asked you to get in touch with the sensual, it's different than the way we're used to getting in touch with the sensual. It's not in a sense of stimulating us, of adding something, but it's in a way opening and freeing our experience. And that's discouraged in a society that values activity, productivity, speed, the mind, imprisonment. The richness and depth of feeling in the body is already about freedom. It's right here. And so for many of you, this is sounding similar to a lot of Dharma language, but it's not contextualized that way necessarily in the Dharma. So in relationship, just quickly, in terms of sex, sexual act, this depth is perverted, she says, into the pornographic. So in the same way we're speeding up in our lives, in our daily mundane lives, we bring that same speed, transactional, productive energy to our sexual lives. As a woman, and I think that this goes across gender and sexuality because we might rotate these roles, I feel that as an imprisonment in the male gaze too. And in this inability for the feminine to have subjectivity, that I noticed, I've talked about this in some groups I lead, I noticed a few years, a point in my life, that my erotic experience, my sexual experience, let's say, was often where I had learned over time to objectify myself, like in the sexual activity itself, and how much that was about this this product, the subjectification, the pornographic. In the rest of our lives, that depth of feeling, of listening, of opening to our own sensual experience, to our own body, it shows up as this scramble to keep up and survive because the system is designed that way. You know, I call it the hustle. just the hustle to just make it is so intense. And it's very hard to slow ourselves out of it because it's our survival. You know, I'm like, I am 45 years old. When am I going to stop living paycheck to paycheck? Like, when do I get to slow down, and how do I reclaim that possibility? And not have to live in collusion with these systems, or at least lessen it. So the erotic is really about thriving and savoring every moment, and that takes space and time, something that is in very scarce possibility for many of us. I don't know if any of you saw that RuPaul interview. I posted it on Facebook. RuPaul is a Dharma teacher. I had no idea. So this is what he says on why drag saves lives, which to me sounds like a big fuck you to patriarchy and capitalism and white supremacy. I don't have my glasses. Says, because you get to a point, why drag saves lives? Because you get to a point where if you're smart and you're sensitive, you see how this all works on this planet. It's like when Dorothy looks behind the curtain like, wait a minute, you're the wizard? And you figure out the hoax that this is all an illusion. There's only a few areas you can go. First, you get angry that you've been hoaxed and you get bitter. But then, take more steps beyond the bitterness and you realize, oh, I get it. Let's have fun with it. It's all a joke. You mean I don't have to stick with one look or one whatever? I can shapeshift? Great. That's when you can save lives, because otherwise the mediocrity and the hypocrisy is so mundane, it's better to just not do it. Because for people who are highly sensitive and super intelligent, I think that's Dharma folks, it's better to just not do it. Because for people who are highly sensitive and super intelligent, it tickles the brain. It gives them something to live for, drag. That's what he's talking about. It's the irreverence. I was the same way when I was 15. I said, I'm going to do this life, but I'm going to do it on my own terms, and I'm never going to join the Matrix. But to do that, we actually have to be able to know we're in the Matrix of this white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. And we have to do that, we have to be able to feel this moment. And that's where our practice comes in. Because, and I've seen this again in many political circles I've been in, and just in my family and life, this belief that we're on a path of liberation, but we're really just spinning in some different theories that sound better and are better in many ways, but they still lock us in that same activity, productivity, race, speed, exhaustion, overwhelm, burnout. And the beauty of this practice, if we can open to it in this way, with this lens, is that it can provide us the space to learn how to bring, to open to the stillness and peace that's already here. The renunciation and simplicity that is a big part of this practice, it helps us quiet the noise to help us see clearly what's true and what's the matrix. Our hurt, our pain, our rage, our fear, our depression, our neuroses, our anxiety, our addictions, our obsessions, most of those are created by these very systems, or the effect of those systems on our families and communities, and this generational passing down. As Krishnamurti put it, you think you're thinking your thoughts, but you're not. You're thinking the culture's thoughts. But if you have no distance from your thoughts, it can get very confusing. Hello, every failed liberation struggle of the past centuries. And I think it's because they denied the feminine. So here's how it played out for a 19th century French May Gale author, Proust, Marcel Proust. This is a great quote that my friend James sent me. That's not James, but she knows James. You all thought Ellie was called James. And it, to me, it speaks of the archetype of the feminine, the masculine, in this description of Mama and Papa. It was a very long time ago, too, that my father ceased to be able to say to me, to say to Mama, let me start again. It was a very long time ago, too, that my father ceased to be able to say to Mama, go with the boy. The possibility of such hours will never be reborn for me. But for a little while now, I have begun to hear again very clearly, if I take care to listen, the sobs that I was strong enough to contain in front of my father and that broke out only when I found myself alone again with Mama. They have never really stopped. And it is only because life is now becoming quieter around me that I can hear them again. Like those convent bells covered so well by the clamor of the town during the day that one would think they had ceased altogether, but which begin sounding again in the silence of the evening. So listening deeply to the cries that are really longing for this feminine, this archetypal mother to hear them. They're there, we just don't hear them the same way we block out the subway noise or the traffic noise. And when we make space and time to be quiet, to listen deeply, we make space for them to be held. So our meditation practice is training us to help us unhook from that noise, from that speed, from that overactivity, and why it's already a gateway into the sacred feminine, if we can look at it that way. Another way I like to think about it is, and this is not a dualistic metaphor, I like that it has three, triad, is our head center, our heart center, and our belly center. And this practice, this culture conditions us to always move upwards into our head to figure it out. For a lot of women, I know for myself, or a lot of people who are conditioned to feel things in the heart or have that tendency, they can also be very heart-centered. And that's not necessarily welcome in certain circles, being very open and emotional. I have a challenge with the belly center. Some of us are more rooted that way. I noticed this week. I was at a meeting, and I was asked to sort of respond to something. And I responded in a way that I think is very usual for me. I went to the head and figured it out. And I thought I was being quite brilliant. And I think that I offered something to the situation, to maybe even what was needed. But it wasn't until 2 days later, when I was reflecting on the talk today, that I realized how not in my body I was. And I was like, oh my God, I'm a fraud. I can't give that talk on Saturday. I don't know anything about being in the body and the feminine. And it just, I was lucky that I was on a plane when I had that realization, because I couldn't go anywhere to try and fix it. I couldn't distract myself with a gadget, which is right now in this point in my life, my primary way of doing it. I think in other points of my life, I would self-medicated with some kind of substance, or even the relational can sometimes be a turning away, you know, to talk it through with someone, we might see it as this very feminine response, you know, to be in relationship, and we need that. But it can often be a turning away just from the feeling. So I was like, okay, get it together, woman. You are a Dharma teacher. So I went into the body, and it was not comfortable. I expected it to feel it here, because it's where I felt a lot of things throughout my life, this grief, this sadness. And, you know, that happens too, but I felt it in my stomach, and I felt like I was sick to my stomach. It was such an uncomfortable feeling, and I just kept opening to it and kept opening to it. And guess what? It was impermanent. And the Buddha said, a finger snap of recognizing impermanence is more powerful than almost all the other practices, realizations. So that opening to our experience and allowing things to arise and pass away, to change, powerful. So I've been thinking of these three things as know yourself, starting from here, love yourself, like really allow and love yourself, and then check yourself. And, you know, sometimes we don't have any of them. And sometimes we can get stuck in one or the other. I think the three in balance are really important. So society as a whole perpetuates this suspicion and diminishment of the erotic, of the feminine, and unfortunately that includes our Dharma communities. I think it can be, it was for me, heartbreaking to realize that the Dharma can be so twisted. And as a longtime practitioner, I've really come to a place in my life where I want to challenge all the forms. And that I have to balance, you know? When am I throwing the baby out with the bathwater? Which is something that we've seen with a lot of Western Dharma. We've thrown out things that we thought are just cultural stuff that we don't need. You know, we just need the meditation part. That's the part that works. My teacher, Tanisra, talks about when they were converting this old English manor into a monastery in England, the monks decided that they were, you know, they were redoing the walls and pointing the brick and doing all this stuff, and there was a big beam in the center of a large space in the building, and they decided they want to take that beam down. So they started to take it down, and the roof started caving in. And so what are we taking down, not recognizing that it's holding up the whole roof? Which is why I wanted to start with chanting. Even if it feels a little bit like, this is not my, what is this? And it's not that you have to do that, or you have to do it like I do it. It's really about finding our way, but looking at things as a whole, feeling into that, what makes sense, what's been left out. Tanisra, again, she talks about, she practiced in Asia for some time in Thailand, and you know, she described it so beautifully that helped me understand that this practice is very young. It's very much about effort and clarity, and can be about progress in a way. There's a very clarity. There are all these metaphors of climbing up mountains or reaching peaks or heights. And what she sees it as is that it was so different in Asia because it was embedded in the yin of the culture and the relationships and the familiar. And what happened, as she describes, we took a young practice and dropped it in a young culture. and how harmful that can be on us. And it was still a patriarchal system. And can we say that as Buddhists? That this has been handed down through a long lineage of patriarchal cultures. Patriarchy's been around for a long time, a lot longer than colonialism, like a couple of millennia more. And there are exceptions, there are texts and practices and teachers, there's wisdom and the possibility for awakening even within that, because it's always here, that possibility. The feminine is always imminent. But it makes it a hell of a lot harder, especially for people who don't look like the model of that awakening. So I'm longing myself for the depth of the erotic in my own spiritual practice of the sacred feminine and really exploring for myself what that looks like and asking you today, what would that look like in your practice? You know, for me, it's looked like many things. Creating support communities that are, for me, women-based and women of color-based. Conversations resonate, you know, really protecting myself from teachers, spaces, conversations that I don't find helpful, even if there's wisdom or liberation possibilities within them. This is an amazing space for those of you who are new to it. Love Circle Sangha as a POC and allies space for looking at the Dharma in relationship to these issues. Because I think that it demands that, and we deserve that. So I'm just going to end with another quote from Audrey from that essay. We're on a first name basis. What I really hear as an exploration of liberation in her words. For once we begin to feel deeply all the aspects of our lives, we begin to demand from ourselves and from our life pursuits that they feel in accordance with that joy which we know ourselves to be capable of. Our erotic knowledge empowers us, becomes a lens through which we scrutinize all aspects of our existence, forcing us to evaluate those aspects honestly in terms of their relative meaning within our lives. And this is a grave responsibility, projected from within each of us, not to settle for the convenient, the shoddy, the conventionally expected, nor the merely safe. So I'd like to lead you all in a reflection. After the reflection, you're going to be sharing about the reflection with another person. So just finding a position that's comfortable. If you have space, you can even lie down or find something that's really restful for you. So allowing yourself to become relaxed, get comfortable, pay attention to your breathing. Just noticing the breath wherever it's easeful to follow. Notice where your body is grounded. So where is your body making contact with a chair or cushion or floor? Really begin to sense that place of contact, the places of contact. As you rest into this listening to the body, you can ask yourself, what's happening now? And what's my relationship to it? Perhaps perhaps there's a particular part of the body, particular sensory experience that's speaking to you. Can you meet it with some spaciousness, some deep listening? And just see if you can rest on one sensation or one area. What does that sensation really feel like? Giving it your attention, awareness, the way you would a dear friend who is troubled or joyful. Noticing how that one thing feels in the whole body. As you gather this capacity to be with your experience, I ask you to reflect, what do you think will support you in your reclamation of the sacred feminine and the erotic in your life? What will support you in your reclamation of the sacred feminine and the erotic in your life? Another way to maybe enter that inquiry, what is your deepest longing? What is calling for your attention? What do you need to let go of to support this? What do you need to let go of to support this process of opening to your deepest longing? And thank you all for coming here. It's really just a privilege to start talking about this publicly as a Dharma teacher and have it be heard by all of you, because it's not talked about very much. And I hope that this will continue for all of us. Thank you. So I'll just close with a sharing of blessings. And I'd like to include the Kuan Yin chant that's in front of you, which is an ancient Mahayana chant that is about this listening capacity. Kuan Yin is said to listen to the sounds of the world. She is the embodiment of this sacred feminine, and in many manifestations is neither one gender or another, and is representing the balance of both. So it's compassion is not only receiving, but it's the response. And can we respond like Kuan Yin from a place of clarity and love? So for those of you who know this chant, can chant with me, and the others can join us if you'd like.
Namo Kuan Shi Yin Pu Sai. Namo Kuan Shi Sai Na Mo Kuan Shi Yin Pu Sai Na Mo Kuan. Shuyin Pusa Aina Mokwan Shuyin Pusa Aina Mokwan Shuyin Pusa.
May the blessings of our time together here this afternoon benefit all beings everywhere without exception. May all beings live in wonder, in mystery, in joy and love, and may all beings be free.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by the Brooklyn Zen Center. Our programs are given free of charge and made possible by the donations we receive. For more information on supporting Brooklyn Zen Center, please visit the giving section of brooklynzen.org.